I'm going to change the protocol of the class in the following way. I'm going to make an opening, whatever, presentation. I'll talk for a while. I'll go through the stuff, and then we'll save the end of the class for questions and comments. So let's start, and but I do want to go back for a minute because I found a neat interpretation of something that we had already gone through, but makes sense. And if you will turn, we're in the book of Genesis. We're struggling with the story of Jacob, and I want you to turn back to 27:41. Okay? And if you look back, we just sort of glided by this verse. It says, Esau harbored a grudge, or actually hated, is another way of putting it. Esau hated Jacob. Why? Because of the blessing his father had given him. Chapter 27, verse 41. Okay, in the book of Genesis. If you don't have a book, you're welcome to sit next to anyone. Everybody will share with you. It's a Torah class. Okay? So, Genesis chapter 27, verse 41. Everybody got?
Yeah.
Okay. Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing his father had blessed him. And everybody, by the way, has a different translation, so don't worry if your English is slightly different. And he said, basically, as soon as my father dies and we're done mourning for him, I'm going to kill him. All right? Rabbi Yehonatan Eibeshitz asks, why is it that when a butcher asks a rabbi if a particular animal that has been slaughtered is kosher or not, and the rabbi rules that it isn't, the man accepts the ruling, even if it means a considerable loss to him? On the other hand, if two men come to a rabbi for a ruling relating to a small amount which is in dispute between them, and one loses the case, he'll be upset and he'll argue with the rabbi endlessly over the verdict. He says, what's the difference between the two? Okay? Well, they both mean money, right? You lose a chicken, it's money. You lose an ox, it's money. I mean, if the rabbi tells you it's not kosher. He answers, when a rabbi declares an animal isn't kosher, it's only the person who asked the question who loses, but nobody else benefits. On the other hand, in a dispute between men, one loses, but the other gains. The one who loses isn't nearly as upset at his loss as he is at the other's gain. The same was true for Esau. He wasn't angry at Jacob for taking his blessing because he had no need for blessings from Isaac. All he needed was, by your sword you will live, which Isaac had already told him, right? Why then did he hate Jacob? Because of the blessing that his father had blessed him, he was angry that his brother got something. I think that's a great analysis, and it makes a lot of sense. As La Rochefoucauld, the French aphorist, said, it is not enough to succeed. One's friends must fail. Right? So, you know, and by the way, if you don't think this is true, then just talk to your kids about the grades they get on a test. Right? I got a B, but so-and-so got a C, so it's okay, right? But if so-and-so gets an A, then the B is not all right. So there is this comparative element, and I just thought that was a wonderful analogy, and I wanted to bring it to your attention, even though we've already passed that a little bit in the text. What's that? The commentary, there's... The man who made the original analogy was named Rabbi Yehonatan Eibeshitz, who actually himself has a really interesting history, but that's separate. He was accused of being a Sabbatian, of being a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. He was a very famous rabbi, and his book is called Ya'arot Devash. I have it upstairs in Hebrew. I don't think it's ever been translated. But the book that I found it in is called Iturei Torah, which is a compendium of Hasidic statements on the Torah with a lot of wonderful stuff, and some of that is translated. There's a digest of it called Torah Gems that's translated, but the main thing is still easily available, Iturei Torah, and is used all the time. Okay, so now we are now over at the next section, which is chapter 28, verse 10. Okay, and we're starting a new section, which again, we covered before, but since we're gearing up for Jacob's life, we're coming now on Jacob's dream. Okay. All right, everybody have chapter 27, verse 10. Jacob leaves Beersheba. 28, verse 10. Okay? Now, let's just bring ourselves up to date. Jacob has stolen his brother's birthright, or not stolen it, or received what he should receive, that God wanted him to receive, and maybe Isaac did, and maybe Isaac didn't. We won't re-enter that controversy. But whatever the story, Jacob has gotten the birthright. Esau wants to kill him. His mother, who arranged the whole escapade, sends him away because she doesn't, she says, want to lose two children in one day. She's lost Esau because Esau resents her, and she doesn't want to lose Jacob because Esau will kill him. So Jacob leaves Beersheba. Now, it says in verse 10, and the rabbis make much of this, Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. Again, if we're going to train ourselves to read the Torah the way the rabbis did, what you will notice is that half of this verse is superfluous. All you have to say is he set out for Haran. If he set out for Haran, he obviously left Beersheba. You can't do one without doing the other. So why does it say he left Beersheba? Most of the commentaries, taking off from Rashi, who is the classical commentator, say when a righteous man leaves a place, that leaves a mark as well. So they felt in Beersheba that Jacob was leaving. Right? They felt his absence in the same way that in Haran they will feel his presence. And so you emphasize that his leaving also has consequences. The other possibility is that it's emphasizing two things. First, that he's leaving home now, right? Beersheba was home, and Jacob's leaving home, and leaving home is always a mark in someone's life. And second, that he's doing the same thing that Abraham did. Isaac is the only one who never left the land of Israel, right? Jacob does, Joseph does, Abraham does, the matriarchs do. Obviously, Isaac marries Rebekah, who was born outside of the land of Israel. Isaac is the only one who never leaves Israel. Now, there are two ways to see that. You can see that as fidelity to the land of Israel, right? He's the one who loves the land of Israel and who never leaves. Or you can see that as a lack of initiative, right? Either way, depending on how you read Isaac's life. But everyone in the Bible, including Moses, including David, in some way becomes great when they leave. David runs away from Saul and accumulates an army, and that's when he comes into his own. Moses goes away to Midian, and it's in Midian that he has the encounter with the burning bush. Remember, it's not while he's in Egypt, it's when he runs away, and he's not in Israel in either place. And Joseph obviously goes to Egypt and becomes great there. Abraham leaves home and goes to Canaan and becomes great there. And this is Jacob's leaving. And Jacob, too, will become great. With the exception of Moses, Jacob is the most interesting character in the Bible because, at least in the five books, I think David is probably the most interesting altogether. But Jacob is so interesting because he really does change. Because the person that we see at the beginning of the story undergoes all sorts of experiences that make him different at the end of the story. And so what we know about Jacob so far is, first of all, that he listens to his mother, but also that he steals the birthright with doesn't seem like any kind of real moral qualm, and that now for the first time he's alone. He doesn't have the protection of his parents. He doesn't have his community around him. He has nothing. And he doesn't, even though he knows he's going to relatives, you have to reimagine what travel in the ancient world is like, right? There are no inns. There's no protection. There are no safe roads. He's going on foot. It's not a pleasant or an easy thing. And you can imagine that the predominant emotion he feels is fear. It's fear because, you know, if you wouldn't walk in the middle of the night alone in a city where there's infinitely more sophisticated civilization than there was in ancient, you know, Canaan, just imagine how he must feel. And it says, he came upon a place, v'yifga ba'makom, okay? Now, makom is also a synonym in the Jewish tradition for God. God is called makom. God is called place. So the reader can read back, once we know what the story is going to be, you can read back and think maybe what he did was he came upon God, but he also came upon a place. The reason that God is called makom, according to the rabbis, is because everything is God's place, right? The whole world is the place of God. And he stopped there for the night, for the sun had set. Now, once the sun is set, I guess you can't travel anymore. Among other things, you can't see where you're going, right? There are no streets lights. There is no, this is a world with no artificial light. You know, William Manchester, who wrote the biographies of Kennedy and of Churchill, wrote a book about the Middle Ages, and the book was titled A World Lit Only by Fire. Think about that. I mean, really, artificial light is so prevalent. Just remember, I remember when the earthquake happened in, what was it, 94, and it was 4:31 in the morning, right? And all the lights went out, and you waited for the sun to come up, right? Unless you had a flashlight, basically you were stuck until the sun came up, because all of a sudden there was no artificial light. And that's the world as it actually exists behind all these lights, and so Jacob, once the sun went down, Jacob had no choice, but he had to stay where he was. And then it says, he took from the stones of the place and put them on and put them under his head. Now, Rashi, reasonably enough, thinks that stones don't make a very good pillow. And he assumes that what Jacob did is not put stones under his head, but rather around him as a barrier, which would make sense. I mean, it affords some small amount of protection. At least you'll hear if someone's trying to break in or whatever, and you'd feel a little bit more comfortable sleeping. Remember, he doesn't have a tent with him, apparently. You'd feel a little bit more comfortable sleeping surrounded by a wall of stones than if you were by yourself. But the tradition is that he put the stones under his head and put his head on it. So, and it says, Me avne hamakom, from the stones of the place, which suggests that he put more than one stone. Right? And the Midrash assumes, the Midrash, again, the rabbinic tradition, assumes that the stones were all arguing to be the one that Jacob would put under his head. And there's this nice little, there's a nice little Midrash that since later the stone is referred to in the singular, it says that actually when you act together, you become as one. And even though the stones were all arguing for priority, once Jacob assembled them, they all acted as one under his head. And similarly, Israel, right, when they act together, it doesn't matter who's first, who's on top, who's on bottom, we act as one. And presumably sometime in Jewish history that will happen, but I can't actually point to a time yet when that succeeded. So anyway, it's a nice idea. And the rabbis are, of course, always looking to the Torah to teach Musar. Musar is morals. So Vayeshkav b'makom hahu, and he lay down in that place. Now, it says, Vayachalom, and he had a dream. The first thing I'll tell you about this dream, even though we'll talk about it a lot, is this is, according to one commentator, and I haven't checked it, but I'm assuming he's right, because I haven't seen anybody contradict him, this is the only uninterpreted dream in the Bible. It's amazing, isn't it? When I read that, I went, really? Wow, that's unbelievable. Every other dream that is offered in the Bible is offered with an interpretation. This one is not. We're never told what this dream means, which is why, of course, this dream has attracted more interpretation than any other dream in the Bible, because fortunately, we're not told what it means. So we get to speculate about it ourselves. Also, the word sulam, which means a ladder, or here they say a stairway, which is, it says, Vayachalom, and he dreamed the Hine Sulam, and behold, there was a Sulam, a ladder, a stairway, whatever. Mutzav Arza, which was set on the ground. Sulam is what is called a hapax legomena, which is a fancy way of saying the word only appears once in the Bible. Okay? And if a word only appears once, then you don't know what it means. Because the way that you know what words mean is by comparing them in different contexts. So that's why you get stairway instead of ladder, but it means some kind. I mean, today in modern Hebrew, a sulam is a ladder, but it means some kind of ladder or stairway. And usually, by the way, in modern biblical scholarship, the way they try to determine if they don't know what a word means is by looking at cognate languages. What does the word mean in Akkadian, Sumerian, Ugaritic, other ancient Near Eastern languages? And some people actually speak those. Still, it's amazing. Okay. Anyway, so the base was stuck in the ground, and the head, or the top, reached towards the sky. It doesn't say it was in the sky. It says magia, which means was reaching towards the sky. And behold, angels of God went up and down it. Okay? So let's first talk about the conventional interpretations and tick those off. One is the angels were with Jacob already. That's why they were going up and down the ladder, because obviously they should be going down and up the ladder since angels come from heaven, right? And there's a lot of discussion about why they're going up and down. So one is that the angels were already with Jacob. That leads to the speculation that there are some angels that guard you when you're in the land of Israel, but when you leave the land of Israel, you get a change of guard, right? So the angels that were guarding him were there, and the other angels, now they were shifting, the other angels were coming. The slight complication is that he's not yet leaving the land of Israel, but you get the idea that now that something else is coming along, some other section of his life or experience of his life, the angels are leaving him. The other interesting part of this is, of course, that, and by the way, the other, let me just stop before I get to God's place in this, the predominant interpretation apart from that is that this represents the change of kingdoms over time, the various kingdoms that Israel will face. And each of them has its guardian angels, and eventually there's a whole series of kingdoms, and eventually, of course, there will be the kingdom of the Messiah. But I'm going to leave that one aside. It's not God, though, who appears, it's angels. And that's also interesting. And you could read this as Jacob's not there yet, right? There's a ladder, which suggests that he still has a ways to go. And there are angels, as opposed to having a direct experience of God. So it is a removed experience. Also, it's an experience of night. And dreams and experiences of night are considered less immediate than experiences of God during the day. That's why Moses is the only prophet, according to the tradition, who saw God during the day, right? Other prophets saw God at night, because that's a lower level of prophecy. So that's the first part. The second part is that Jacob is having what's called a theophany, that is an experience of the divine. And that's a very powerful thing, and it's why when he wakes up, he calls it Beit El, right, the house of God. But let's think for a second about what it is that contributes to experiences of God. So, among other things, in our world, we tend to think of experiences of God as things that are set. That is, you're supposed to go to synagogue to have an experience of God, or you go to nature to have an experience of God. But this is obviously a surprise for him, right? He had no idea that he was about to have this experience of God. At least it doesn't seem so. And what's that? Right, well, the temple wasn't built yet. But there is something to that, actually, that because what I was going to say is that Moshe Greenberg, in his book about biblical prayer, talks about the fact that all the prayers in the Bible, the early prayers in the Bible, are all spontaneous prayers, that there are no fixed prayers, that there is no ritual, that there is no temple, that all those things actually don't exist yet. And what you're seeing here is a sort of natural, spontaneous overflow of the human religious impulse. And Jacob has an experience of God unbidden, that is, that he doesn't ask for, that all of a sudden overwhelms him. And those of you who weren't here at the beginning may not have heard that we're going to do a presentation, and then at the end we're going to leave time for questions and comments. And so part of what he's going through here, we can look at in terms of, first of all, his life. Let's look at it from Jacob's point of view, and then let's look at it from God's point of view. Okay, he ran away from home. He's alone for the first time. He's scared. He's looking for some reassurance. And also, he is, as we discover just from the course of his life, a highly sensitive, imaginative person. So put all that together, you get an experience of God. From God's point of view, this is the first time that he has a chance to touch Jacob. Because Jacob before this is home. He's under his mother's protection and care. He's being raised in a house with a brother who is overwhelming, right? Because you've got to assume that it's not easy to be Esau's brother. And this is the first time that God has him alone, so to speak. And in the same way, this is a bad analogy, but you'll understand. In the same way that if a teacher wants to connect with a student, they have them stay after class, because you can't do it while all the other kids are around. This is the first time that God actually has a chance to speak separately to Jacob. And the first time also that we see the situation where God comes to someone. You know, we know that God comes to Noah, but we don't know actually what Noah was doing at the time. We know that God comes to Abraham, but we don't really know what Abraham was doing at the time. But now when God comes to Jacob, we actually see what Jacob was doing, and we can understand why this is the moment. And that all that may be why what happens is then after he sees the angels and he has been prepped, God can appear. Right? And what does God say? And the Lord was standing beside him, Nitzav Elav. Now, how God stands beside him will come to in a second. And he says, I am God, the God of your fathers, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac, the ground on which you are lying, I will assign to you and your offspring. Your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You'll spread out to the west, the east, the north, the south. All the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you and your descendants. Remember, I am with you. Okay? Vihine, by the way, is the Hebrew, which means and behold. But remember might serve as well. I'll protect you wherever you go. I'll bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I've done what I promised. Now, there are lots of things about this that are interesting. First of all, it's clear God obviously knows what Jacob is feeling, and this is a blessing to a scared person, right? I will be with you. I won't leave you till I do this. Don't fear. And you don't do that unless Jacob was in fact feeling that, and you'll see later on from his reaction that he's still feeling it, right? God's reassurance wasn't quite enough for him. But one of the things I just want to say that may or may not be intended this way, but it says at the end, you know, I won't leave you until I've done what I promised, which suggests that once God's done what he's promised, what? He leaves him. Right, exactly. Which may mean that then Jacob will die. That's possible, right? Although actually Jacob does die in Egypt and gets carried back to Israel, but it's interesting to speculate about that. These sentences, and you're not sure if they mean what they seem to mean, like that. One that always intrigued me is one that we say in the Aleinu. You know, when you, at the end of the Aleinu, you say, Bayom Hahu, Yiyar Anayachad Ushmo Achad, which means, on that day, God will be one and his name one. So if you're saying, on that day, God will be one, then how many is God today? I mean, that's a very puzzling sort of statement, right? So here too, I'm going to do all this for you and I won't leave you till I do. Does that mean that God, you know, basically fulfills promises and then goes away? It's a little troublesome. Anyway, but as we pointed out last time, and we're going to close with a blessing, talk about the blessing a little bit, and then we'll take questions and comments. As we talked about last time, this is not a blessing that Isaac gave to Esau or gave to Jacob when Jacob stole Esau's blessing. And it sounds as though this blessing, the blessing of the land, was a blessing that was only going to be intended, right? This is a blessing that only Jacob gets. Esau never got it or was intended to. And the other thing that intrigues me is I'm guessing, and I can't say this for sure, but I'm guessing that this blessing doesn't mean as much to Jacob as you might think. And that's why after he gets up, he says, you know, I want to make sure that you're going to protect me. Because a young man doesn't care so much about his descendants. Really. To say to a 17-year-old man, your great-grandchildren will inherit this land, means nothing. He's a kid. He wants, if God had said, you will, you know, you will make a lot of money and you'll marry sisters and have lots of children, then maybe he'd be interested. But this whole descendants thing doesn't, now, and part of this is the idea that God speaks to your future self, not just to your present self. And Jacob will remember this and later on it will matter to him. But at the moment, I can't believe that Jacob cares so much that God is going to eventually give lands to his descendants, although God wants to plant that thought in Jacob's mind because it will matter to him. And obviously, this is one of the transitions that Jacob makes, right? Because at the very end in the parsha we're about to read this week, what's Jacob doing? He's blessing his children for the future because now he's an old man and he's about to die and now he cares about what happens in the future. But here is a young man, my guess is that he's not beginning to think about his grandchildren or great-grandchildren. The other thing that I want to bring to your attention is how strange it is that God says, your father Abraham, and doesn't say, your father Isaac. Isaac's his father. So why does he say, your father, the God of your father Abraham and of Isaac? Now, one possibility is that, you know, Abraham is the dominant figure in the life of this family. And until Jacob comes along, there isn't anybody. I mean, Isaac doesn't begin to compete with the force of his father. He just doesn't. And so Abraham is in some, and the second side of that is Jacob reminds us much more of Abraham than he does of Isaac. I mean, Isaac is just not, you know, I mentioned before when we were talking about Isaac, the beautiful analogy that my father once gave in talking about Isaac, which is Moses Mendelssohn, the great philosopher, had a grandson who was Felix Mendelssohn, the great composer. But he also had a son who was a very successful banker. His name was Abraham Mendelssohn. And at the end of his life, Abraham Mendelssohn said, the first half of my life, I was the son of my father. The second half of my life, I was the father of my son, right? Because he was successful and smart and all that, but he was unlucky enough to have a genius as a father and a genius as a son. And that was sort of Isaac's fate, right? So Isaac is a bridge, but it's not, you know, it's hard to see him. And so it's almost as if God is acknowledging to Jacob that he knows who Jacob models himself after. And he knows that Isaac is not Jacob's model, but Abraham is. And so he speaks about Abraham as your father. But that's a very interesting thing. I would also say it was a society in which grandparents played a much greater psychic role than they tend to today, right? Because they were, you know, they were patriarchs and matriarchs of the family. And that's a very different sort of role from the way most grandparents are perceived today. All right. Your descendant shall be as the dust of the earth. This is a phrase that's used several times in the Bible and is sometimes thought of as positive, sometimes thought of as negative. The idea that they're on the dust, that they are the dust of the earth, the rabbis sometimes say that means, obviously, that we will spread out all over the world. The rabbis also say the dust of the earth is what people step on, and that that's also part of Jewish history, is that the Jews have suffered from being the dust of the earth in that way because they've had this this terrible history of not being not being exalted among the nations. Let's put it that way. The stone by which Jacob's head rests as he dreams will become a pillar, the commemorative or cultic marker, which is, as Fokelman, who's a biblical commentator, notes, Jacob's personal motif. From the stones at his head to the stone marker, then the stone at the well that he rolls away, and the pile of stones he will set up to mark with his, to mark with Lavan when they make a treaty. Okay. In the ancient world, piles of stones were religious artifacts. Not artifacts, not the right, religious monuments. Stonehenge, right? If you go to, there are stone circles. In fact, Stonehenge is the most famous, but there are stone circles all over the UK. That's, if you think about it, if you want to build a lasting monument to something powerful in the ancient world, the only way to do it is stone. And probably in the modern world too, if you want to build something lasting. So this idea of stone being a motif for Jacob is a powerful one, and the idea of Jacob leaving a lasting monument sort of, I suppose, has some intersection with this. All right, let's stop for a couple minutes and take questions and comments. Yeah.
Abraham the father, it could also be that that the promise that God made to Jacob was a promise that God made Abraham, but he didn't make to Isaac. So the reference to Abraham could be that he's making the same
promise. Could be.
The question is about the dream. Why is it that this all happened in a dream, and what is the significance of it being a dream rather than real time?
Okay, we're going to talk about the idea of dreams in a second, but let's leave it for a second. It's a great question, and we'll come back to dreams in a minute. Yeah. Integrative, right. Could well be. It could well be. The one thing that I'll say about that is if that's true, and it could well be, then we're in trouble, because in the modern world, we're never alone. Really never alone. I mean, in fact, this off the pulpit, the thing that I send out each week, this week is about noise. That you can't escape noise. You go into the mall and there's music playing. You're in your car and there's a radio playing. And the aloneness, I mean, Jacob had more aloneness at home in his growing up, being, you know, going out into the fields and so on, than somebody living in Los Angeles has in their entire lifetime. So if that's true, then we've got problems of integration. Yeah.
Yeah. The verse that says, and the Lord was standing beside him. This is as close as someone can get to seeing God, unless that's just part of his dream. And if that's part of his dream and the rest of the verse is following, he's dreaming his own blessing?
Not at least according to the Bible. This is clearly God who is blessing him. And God's appearance in the Bible, we talked about this, I remember, I don't know if it was last year or 2 years ago, and maybe we'll talk about it again. This is Kugel's book, God of Old, where he talks about the fact that God appears all the time in the Hebrew Bible. It's not unusual for God to appear. There are contradictory statements, though, where it says that you can't see me and live. But God's appearance, I mean, remember, God, it says that God appears to Abraham, and then he looks up and sees three angels. So the notion that God appears to people isn't strange. We're not told what God looks like except in one very, very cryptic statement in when Moses asks God to show him his goodness, and God says, you can't see my face, but you can see my back, and he looks and there's like a brickwork of sapphire. But the Bible itself is much less uncomfortable with God described humanly than we are. God's described humanly in the Bible all the time. Yeah.
It seems to me that when you're talking about the celebratory aspect of this Jacob's ladder and going up and down, the gloriousness of it, where before he had been, the blessing had already been in conflict, he'd always had the twin brother. Mm-hmm. It might be his, it might not be his, but you steal it, his, and all that. The disappearance is really, whether he took it up as meaning he's happy forever and all that, it was really emotionally a rather glorious experience. He had more gratitude than envy in it for the first time.
So, right, the symbolism of the ladder is definitely a symbolism of sort of exaltation. You know, the rabbis talk about ladders. In fact, there's one midrash that says, what has God been doing since finished creating the world? And the answer is, God's been building ladders for some people to go up and others to go down. And there's a beautiful poem from Yeats that talks about, and now I lay down, where all ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. The idea being that ladders are what allow you to climb out of whatever you're in, and they have a promise, obviously, of someplace better and higher. And the Kotzker Rebbe also says something about ladders. He asks, if someone is on the 10th rung of the ladder and someone's on the 3rd rung, who's higher? And his answer is, it depends what direction they're going. So all of those things are all of those things suggest that ladders are this tool, and maybe it is a metaphor for Jacob's possibility of going up or going down. But I agree that it's a very different and sort of powerful and exultant image from where he came from. Yes, Angie, and then Norm. Go ahead. Yes. Yeah. It was both. You get both images at various times. Stars of the heaven and dust of the earth, you get both. I don't remember everywhere that dust of the earth is, but I can take a look and tell you. It's the one to Abraham is in chapter 13. It says, verse 16, and I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth. That's chapter 13, verse 16. So that if one can count the dust of the earth, then your offspring too can be counted. Norm. Lovely.
And after being through a real personal problem,
right,
and seeing the warmth and the love of so many people in this congregation, I would only tell you again, there's so many angels like you.
And not only is that a beautiful interpretation, but you really have a lot of biblical support for that, because when Abraham sees angels, as Kugel points out, he doesn't initially see them as anything other than human beings. He doesn't say, oh my God, look at these strange creatures. He says, let's go get them something to eat, because he obviously sees them as human. So I think that it's lovely. Anyway, yeah. Right. So we are actually all dust sooner or later.
Right.
So we do all cover the world with dust. Yeah.
So it seems that there's something very special about this earthly place, where place is mentioned a lot, where earth,
right,
is mentioned a lot, dust. It also seems like the stones, which is where he puts his head, and that's where the dream comes from. It says the ladder comes from the earth, descends the earth, and goes towards the heaven. The angels come from the earth, go up, and then go down. So it seems that, I mean, I don't know another.
Yes, and we're going to come to that. The only reason I didn't talk about the place, but it's important, is because it fits better once he calls it Beit El, the house of God. But I will, I want to return to the dream while we have at least a few minutes, and also to one other possible significance of the idea of the ladder. Yes, two more comments and then I will. Yeah.
Question, when you're speaking of the angels, are you speaking of God? I mean, are they...
It's a good question. The traditional idea is that angels are functionaries. They're messengers. They do what God says. So they're not God, but they don't have independent wills, really. And the idea that angels have independent wills is a much later development. Even in the book of Job, where there is an angel called Satan, Satan can't do anything that God doesn't allow Satan to do. So it's not like Milton, basically. Yeah.
Well, sort of regarding that, I wondered if it wasn't a non sequitur to go from, and the angels of God were going up and down, and then the next sentence is, and the Lord was standing beside him.
Yes.
So,
I don't know if it's a non sequitur, but it's a jarring,
right.
Yes, juxtaposition. Yes.
But
if you, it's true that it's different, but if you, for example, the question was, isn't it jarring to go from the angels were going up and down and God stood next to him? And that's why you would think, are the angels the same as God? But there are various, if you remember the vision of Isaiah, in Isaiah, the chapter 6, the one that has Kadosh, 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 where Isaiah goes up to heaven and there are all these angels around him, but then he sees God on a lofty throne. So there you have all these problems. One is he sees God, but also angels are clearly different from God. And in fact, he says, how can I prophesy? Because I have unclean lips, uncircumcised lips. And an angel comes over and burns his lips with a coal, with tongs, and then he can speak, which is very reminiscent of the Moses motif, right, of burning his lips and so on. But okay, I want to return for a second, We'll come back, I'm sure, to that, especially when Jacob wakes up and we hear what he has to say about all this, but we won't see that till next week, to the idea of a dream and also what connects heaven and earth. Now, in Kabbalah, you know, what connects heaven and earth are the Sfirot. And the Sfirot are God's emanations, and they are like a ladder. I mean, there are lots of different ways of picturing the Sfirot. Sometimes they're pictured like a human body. Sometimes they're pictured like a ladder, even though it doesn't look like the ladder that you use, you know, today doesn't look like a workman's ladder, but the idea that there are certain places where that connection is especially powerful is something we'll come to when Jacob wakes up. But the notion that heaven and earth are tied together is in some ways the biggest lesson of the story. That is, Jacob feels very separate from the world above him, but in fact he's not separate, and all it takes is the dream. And why the dream? My sense is there are lots and lots of theories about what dreams are, right? And they will continue, especially now that they're doing, MRI scans of brains. Did any of you see 60 Minutes this past week? Did you see my brother?
Yes.
Good. That was my brother, yes. The guy who said, I always tell my students there's no such thing as science fiction, that's my brother. Just a little PR for the Wolpe family. It was great, 60 Minutes, you know. So the idea of what dream interpretations will be obviously is going to continue. But one of the things that seems clear is that dreams allow you to think in ways that you can't think when you're awake. That is, they create associations that are hard to create when you're awake, and they release other associations or other blocks. And so you can piece together puzzles that you can't when you're awake, and maybe Jacob had this spiritual component to himself, but it couldn't find expression at home. And not only could it not find expression at home, but he almost couldn't allow himself to have it consciously when he left home, because he was still so close to home. It took a release from something that wasn't conscious. Especially because you realize Jacob had to have an enormous amount, not only of fear, but of guilt. He just stole his brother's birthright. He was just kicked out of the house. His brother wants to kill him. He knows he tricked his father. His mother says, run away because I don't want you to die. He's got to be, right? I mean, this is a horrible situation for a human being to be in, whether he brought it on himself or not. It's still a horrible situation. So the dream could allow him to explore something that he otherwise has no chance to explore. And that is, you know, the rabbis say in the Talmud that a dream is like a letter, that it awaits its interpretation. And an uninterpreted dream is like an unopened letter. So it could be that only a dream would allow him the release to discover what was inside him. And there is, I read a book a few years ago about dreams. And somewhere in it, there was at least one scientist who actually, his assumption was from studying brainwave patterns, I don't remember the details, I just remember the upshot of this, that people are actually dreaming all the time, but at a very low level. And you have to turn off the conscious mind for dreams to emerge. In the same way that sleep is actually the default mode of human beings. And there is a chemical that keeps us awake. But there's a reason why if you are programmed that way, whether you're tired or not, almost any time you lie down, you can fall asleep. Because in fact, that's the default mode of the brain is sleep, and it takes something extra to keep you awake. And he was saying the default mode of the brain is dreaming, and it takes something extra. The effort is in being conscious, not in dreaming. So I just thought that was an interesting theory. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's yes, exactly right. Yeah, how about that? Go ahead. Right, you turn off parts of the brain that. There's Jewish meditation, but I'm not aware of something that you would call meditation in the Bible, unless you think, as some do, that when it says that Isaac was lasuach basadeh, some people translate that as meditating in the field. Yeah.
So if I come back to my question about the dream originally, right. The interpretation that you just gave was an interpretation from the person's point of view, from Jacob's
right.
point of view.
Well, from God's point of view, as I said, God comes to prophets in dreams, but only to Moses, not in dreams.
Yeah, so So why, if God wants to come, why doesn't God just come? Why does it take a dream for God to be there?
It doesn't take a dream, but that's all. That's as much communication as God will give you. Maybe because people are more receptive at that time. I mean, that's one possibility. Another possibility is that God doesn't communicate explicitly. God communicates in symbols, images, because God's message is greater than the vessel of explicit words and ideas. Do you know what I mean? In the same way, think of it this way. If I say to you, sum up the American flag in words, whatever summary you give will always miss part of the symbolism of the flag, because you actually can't summarize a symbol in words. So maybe God speaks in greater messages than words can carry.
Well, this may not be very Jewish, but in sort of a modern theory of dreams, dreams are your own brain's fantasy.
Right.
And you dream things that mean something else. So
yes.
What's the possible interpretation that Jacob sort of fantasized his own relationship with God and became great because he built it in his fantasy?
I mean, it's not... That's okay. You can take God out of the Bible as a real character and make God a creation of human beings. But I mean, and that's certainly done by everybody who reads the Bible as a purely human product. But that's not, for my own money, that's not the way Jacob had his experience. So, yeah.
So you think that Jacob was 17 when he had this dream?
Well, he was a young man. Let's put it that way. So, yeah.
I think maybe a middle ground with this idea of dreams is that if God communicates to you in your dream, then upon your waking, you essentially have a choice to make.
Right.
Because you can't really know if God appears to you in the day in front of you, that's pretty irrefutable. But right. If it's in your dream, upon reflection,
that's a nice idea. It also, if you think about it this way, if you say that it's entirely a product of Jacob, which, I mean, obviously has been argued and can be argued, but the question is, do you believe that there's something greater than human beings? And can human beings have some intuition or sense of it? If you believe yes, then Jacob's dream tapped into something real. If you think no, then Jacob's dream was purely a fantasy of Jacob's mind. But I go with one. Yeah.
I have a question about the blessing. Is it like a messianic blessing that you're going to be spread all over?
It seems that way. Well,
is that the first time that you see
it? Well, we saw it with Abraham, too, remember? Well, he says you'll be the dust of the earth. He says the dust of the earth. It doesn't say north and south, but it says the dust, like the dust of the earth, which, yeah. I would say there are two ways of reading this. One is that everybody will be Jewish, right? The Jews will spread all over the world. The other is that the essence of what Judaism has to teach will spread all over the world, right? That's Maimonides' reading of it. Maimonides does not assume, actually, that everyone will be Jewish in the Messianic age. What Maimonides assumes is that everybody will know God. He finishes his great code of law by quoting Isaiah, and knowledge of the earth will spread over the world as the waters cover the sea, right? In other words, it'll be everywhere, it'll be saturating. But he never says that everybody will convert to Judaism. Quite the opposite. He says, for example, the lion laying down with the lamb means big nations and small nations will settle their conflicts peacefully. So if you want to reread the promise, not the way, by the way, the tradition read it. The tradition read it as there'll be lots and lots of Jews all over. But if you want to reread it as what God is promising is that Judaism, as opposed to Jews, will be all over the world, that's a much more possible promise given, right, the situation of the world. And even that one seems, unfortunately, sadly far off.